You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Odin was the father of Wekta, who was the father of Witha, who is the father of Withgils, who had two sons named Hengist and Horsa. Vortigern, king of the Britons, was besieged from invaders and sought support of mercenaries. The two brothers, Hengist and Horsa, brought men from Saxony to support Vortigern. They were successful and were rewarded with lands on the eastern shore of the island and maintained peace with the Britons for some time. Vortigern fell in love with Hengist's daughter and married her, leading to demands by Hengist, who said, "As I am your father, I claim the right of being your counselor. Do not therefore slight my advice, since it is to my countrymen you must owe the conquest of all of your enemies. Let us invite over my son Okta and his brother Ebessa, who are brave soldiers, and give them the countries that are in the northern parts of Britain, by the wall, between Deira and Alba, for they will hinder the inroads of the barbarians, and so you shall enjoy peace on the other side of the Humber." The Britons were angry with Vortigern's commiserating with the mercenary invaders and found a new king to lead them. This new king, the great King Arthur, burned Vortigern's castle with him in it and marched to meet the Saxons in the great battle of Badon. King Arthur was victorious, and the Britons were able to contain the Saxons for years to come.
You're listening to the History of Modern Politics. My name is Chris Spangle, and that was the voice of Matt Whitliff talking about the great King Arthur. And in this episode, we're going to focus on Britain from 410 to 825 and really lay out a lot of definitions that will help us in future episodes just to kind of move us along so we don't confuse you when we talk about some of these terms in the future. But you started with King Arthur, and he's a famous knight, you know, the basis of Monty Python's famous movie. But was King Arthur actually a real person?
We have no idea. Like, the historicity is really debated. There's no real evidence. And, you know, the stories that I told you there at the beginning are drawn from about six different sources, never laid out exactly like this. So I took some creative license with telling the story, but you know, a lot, there are references in Bede to this Battle of Badon. Arthur's not named explicitly. The whole idea of King Arthur really comes later in the 1200s and the 1300s, and the myth of King Arthur rises up. But there are numerous people who historically may have actually been King Arthur or something like it. So, but it's interesting, right? Because we hear references to Deira, Alba, that, you know, Alba was the name for Scotland at the time, the invaders. Like, so there is definite history that ties together here, whether these events actually happened like this, whether or not Hengist and Horsa are actually the descendants of Odin. Probably debatable. Hengist is actually also named in reference, possibly the same Hengist in Beowulf, right? As fighting off with the Danes back on the continent. So it's interesting how all these pieces of folklore and mythology come together. And there are, you know, references to it throughout the historiography that we kind of cover in this period. So I think it's a cool way to set up what we're going to learn today in the Anglo-Saxons coming to Britain.
Yeah, one thing about this period is there wasn't a lot of literacy, and so it was told through stories. I mean, when you think of ancient Greece, you often think of mythology and the Iliad and the Odyssey, and you know, the Battle of Troy, for instance, it was so significant in the minds of people, but nobody knows what's history and what's not. And there's a lot of that, especially within the King Arthur myth, that carries forward in Beowulf, and in the intro that you just mentioned, you see the blending of so many different stories, and that's partly due to the fact that the island of Britain is a mixture of natives and people from Ireland and people from Scotland and the Germanic tribes and the Franks in France and then the Scandinavians and the Danes and Vikings. And there's just so many different terms that we want to kind of nail down just so as we move forward and talk about some of this stuff, we don't get confused. But it all ultimately will lead to a unified England and an England that we understand better because of greater literacy rates, especially after the Normans and once we get to the Magna Carta era in the 1200s. But again, we're in the 400 to 800s right now. And this period is when you really start to see a Christian Britain emerge. And obviously the influence of Christianity cannot be overstated in both the legal and the cultural development of the island and eventually our politics as well. Now, the Anglo-Saxons were pagans and they were followers of Norse mythology. And this begins to change in the 6th and 7th centuries. So let's start with some of these tribes and nailing down some of the people that make up the ethnicities and movement of the modern-day British person. Let's start with the Germanic tribes. Tell us a little bit about the Germanic tribes during the migration period and into the 5th century, Matt.
Yeah, Chris. So, you know, we've covered this notion of barbarians and the Germanic tribes in our previous episodes in the context of the Roman Empire. And now let's like kind of try to pull it together. So this era in history by historians is referred to as the migration period because all of these Germanic peoples, who are a broad set of people with a common ethno-linguistic heritage, initially identified as early as by Julius Caesar. If you remember, he kind of separated the Gauls and the Celts as like the, you know, kind of barbarians. And then the Germanic people, they're the real barbarians, right? And this is where it kind of all starts. So you've got the Gauls to the west, of the Germanic people. They all reside in what is kind of central northern Europe at the time. And to the east of that, we'll hear these names later are the Sarmatians, and they're, you know, a kind of Slavic, Iranian, Scythian people. So the Germanic folks, we can divide into several subgroups, and we'll start with the North Germanic tribes. The North Germanic tribes over time, you know, this phrase, the name go to the Northmen, the Norsemen, and it is really the Scandinavians who originated in modern day Sweden, branching over into Norway and into Denmark. The most notable tribe in this group are the Suiones, which today we know as the Swedes and ultimately the Danes. You also have the Geats. They're referenced in the story of Beowulf. And that may or may not be the Goths, but the Goths, you know, kind of also come from some of this same origin. And then we have other tribes that we'll discuss in some of the next few groups that may have originated in Sweden, but are in terms of the subgroups of the Germanic peoples, you know, ultimately landed in some other places. So we then move to the East Germanic peoples. This is modern day Poland and include tribes such as the Burgundians who, you know, end up in southern France eventually, establishing the Burgundian kingdom in 411. We'll talk about that more in next week's episode or next time's episode. Then we do have the Goths, which ultimately split into the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths and play a big role in the fall of the Western Roman Empire. And then the Vandals who, you know, start over here in modern day Poland, but ultimately, you know, are end up in modern day Spain and North Africa and scattered across islands in the Mediterranean. And yeah, Vandals, that's where we get the word vandalism right today.
They just moved in and just started messing things up. Yeah. And then moving west, you have the Elbe tribe, the Germanic peoples who originated in modern day Germany, the Czech Republic and Slovakia. And they include this group of people basically are often grouped together in the broader term of the Swabic or Swabian people. The Lombardians, who ultimately migrated south and settled in northern Italy, the Bavarians, of which I am descended, of which the German state of Bavaria is named, and various tribes in confederation known as the Alemanni, who settled in modern-day Switzerland and the Alsace, eastern France on the border with Germany. And then further west, all right, so you're moving towards, you know, towards France, the Weser Rhine, which is in west-central Germany today. The only notable tribe among this group are the Franks, but they're a big deal, and we'll talk about them in future episodes. Now, rotating north and east from the Franks into northern Germany and Denmark and a bit of the Netherlands, we have the North Sea Germanic tribes. And this is the key group of interest for our episode today. Notably, the Jutes from the north of the Jutland Peninsula, modern-day Denmark. The Angles from the southern end of the Jutland Peninsula, the modern region of the Schleswig-Holstein. The Saxons, south and west of the Angles along the German coast of the North Sea. And the Frisians, further west along the North Sea coast of modern-day Netherlands and Germany.
I love geography. I don't know about you.
I know. I hope we did a good job kind of visualizing that in your mind. But, you know, if we didn't do a great job, you can always go look at the map. And there's tons of maps out there. And I'll put some in the show notes for you guys that'll show you some of the breakup of some of this stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, these migration patterns of the Germanic peoples, it's broad. And as you can see, they ended up, you know, started kind of all in this general area. We kind of rotated clockwise around where the various subgroups came. But, you know, it's the North Sea Germanic people, the tribes that we noted especially started to cross the North Sea and moved west into the island of Britain. And we didn't mention it in the last time's episode with the end of kind of the Roman period, but I mean, there was a whole thing called the Saxon Coast because the invasions from the Saxons was already beginning. There was an official Roman post, military post that was called like the Office of the Saxon Coast that resided on both sides of the English Channel on southern Britain and northern modern day France, which is Normandy today, right? Because of all the activity and the migration that was coming, particularly from the Saxons.
Yeah, and the North Sea is you think of the United Kingdom, and just to the right of that is the North Sea. And then a little down, you have Amsterdam and the Netherlands and Belgium, and Brussels are kind of down to the lower right. And then directly across from the UK, you have Denmark and Copenhagen. And then just kind of pointing northeast, think of 2 o'clock, you've got Norway and Sweden and Finland and like the little thumb looking thing that comes down and points towards the United Kingdom. So hopefully that helps you kind of visualize it. Now let's move back to Britain and talk about the transition of power in Britain, because we've covered already the Romans left the island and the local power starts to increase. The migrating tribes are successful at ultimately assuming leadership, both culturally and politically. And this transition is not well understood, but happened across the 5th and 6th centuries. And it's all very confusing because you have so many different groups of people invading the island and taking over and a lot of turmoil and turnover. But we end up emerging into something called the Heptarchy, or Seven Kingdoms. What is the Heptarchy, Matt?
Yeah, so, you know, there are seven kingdoms that ultimately emerge through this period of time where the Germanic peoples who have come over, mostly it is the Saxons, the Angles, the Jutes, and the Frisians, establish different strongholds that ultimately, you know, consolidate regional power bases and, you know, come into becoming these seven kingdoms, which historians now refer to as the Heptarchy. So again, we're going to do some geography here because this will set the stage for understanding the dynamics in future episodes as we kind of think through the power struggles on the island. So we start in the north with Northumbria. This is parts of modern day Scotland, and really it's the territory north of the river Humber, which you know was referred to in the open as well. So Northumbria is in the north.
Humber. So if you Google it, it's H-U, not U-M-B-R.
That's right. And yeah. So the Humber is a large estuary. It's not even a river, on the eastern shore of the island of the North Sea. And it's to the south of the Picts and the Caledonians, the tribes that are part of Scotland today that were constantly invading and causing trouble for the Celtic and Romanic Britons.
Hence the Antonine and the Hadrian's Wall.
Exactly. And so this area was settled by the Angles and had two sub-kingdoms, Bernicia in the north and Deira in the south, but it was ultimately merged into this one single kingdom of Northumbria around 654.
And then you have East Anglia, which was the kingdom to the south of Northumbria, also along the coastline, and that bumps out into the east on the North Sea there. And it was also settled by the Angles, defended to the west by the... It had like a natural barrier with the marshlands of the Fens and the North Sea on the north and east. And it was split into the North and South Folk that gave us the names of Norfolk and Suffolk.
And then moving to the south of East Anglia, we have Essex, one of the many X's, right, as we kind of think through it. And that's named after the fact that these were the East Saxons, Essex. And the most notable city was London, which under Roman times was Londinium, already a pretty major center in city. But that was the center of power inside of Essex.
And then in the far southeastern corner of Britain, so think like 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, is Kent. And it is located where the island is closest to the mainland Europe, and it is settled by the Jutes. Canterbury served as the seat of Kent.
And then moving along west along the southern coast, so as Chris is referring to on the clock, down to 6 o'clock and a 7 o'clock on the island of Britain, you have the South Saxons. This becomes the Kingdom of Sussex. This area, obviously settled by the Saxons, at various times also included Hastings and the Isle of Wight. Those areas had originally been settled by the Jutes, but ultimately was taken over by the Saxons.
And then further to the west and inland to the north of Sussex is Wessex. As you can imagine, it's west of Sussex. And this is named for the Saxons as well as their western kingdom. Now, the southwest of the island, modern-day Devon and Cornwall, remained held by the Celtic Britons along modern-day Wales. So, you know, Wales is sort of at the... I need to look at my clock.
The 8, 9 o'clock of
Britain.
Yep, and then north of Wessex and east of Wales is, and south of Northumbria, is Mercia. Mercia sits in the center of England. It is, I guess, where the hands of the clock are emanating from, right? And Mercia was settled also by the Angles, right? So they share this heritage with Northumbria and really became the key center of power in the first couple of centuries as Anglo-Saxon rule begins to come together. And Anglo-Saxon, you know, at this time was not a phrase, was not a word, right? But it's come throughout history to become the name to capture not just the Angles and the Saxons, but the entirety of the North Sea Germanic tribes that came over to Britain. So the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes, and the Frisians.
Yeah, I think an important thing to keep in mind here is, A, just the lack of population. And, you know, towns were not 5,000 people. Like, if you had a town of 5,000 people in modern-day Britain, it'd be tiny. But we're talking hundreds of people banded together, smaller tribes, and you have no real communication. So, you know, there's riding a horse from Wessex to Essex to Northumbria. Like, it's not possible in the same way that we can think of a bigger political state in the modern day. It was a much smaller island. And so that's why you have these disparate groups. But you start to see some centralization begin to take place. And explain the concept of Bretwalda. What exactly is that?
Yeah, so we get the name of a Bretwalda from our friend Bede, the monk who was in Northumbria and one of the few chroniclers of the time that we have historical records from. And so Bede notes that there were a handful of Bretwaldas who came to have supremacy over the other kingdoms of the Heptarchy. And so there's some dispute as to how this word actually translates, but it's either broad ruler, right? A wide ruler, Bretwalda, or a ruler of Britain. You know, so that is how this comes. And Bede gives us a list of the people who were Bretwaldas. And the first Anglo-Saxon king to have that name or that title bestowed upon him was Ella. We don't know much about Ella. He is noted by Bede and other chroniclers. So there's multiple references to him. And we believe he reigned from around the 480s to the 510s. You know, interestingly, back to our story in the open, there is some, you know, possibility that he was actually the leader of the Saxons who fought against King Arthur, whomever it was, in that Battle of Badon.
So a few generations pass before the next Bretwalda comes to power, and that's Ceolwin of Wessex, and he likes
Cholin.
All right. That's Ceawlin. These Anglo-Saxons need to get it together for 21st century Americans. Now, he likely reigned from the 560s until about 590, when his power was eclipsed by Ethelbert of Kent. And this transition is notable because Wessex later becomes the power base of future kings, and Kent is the site of emerging Christian power in Anglo-Saxon Britain. More on that in a little bit. So Bede goes on to mention four more Bretwaldas, and the last three of whom are from Northumbria, suggesting that the North had broad power of the South during this time, essentially the first half of the 7th century. So, you know, tell us a little bit more about the concept of Bretwalda and some of these kings.
Yeah. So, you know, now the power starts to transition south into the kings of Mercia. And so the second to last Bretwalda in Bede's list is Oswiu, who's, you know, recognized now as a saint by the Church of England. So, you know, Christianity is fully coming to the island. Oswiu is killed in a battle against King Penda of Mercia at the Battle of Mazurfield in 641. And this now establishes the period known as the Mercian supremacy within the Heptarchy. And Mercia is now the center of power for much of the next 200 years, really into the early 800s. And the height of their power comes during the reigns of King Offa and King Chonwulf. We're not going to be able to get into all of the stories here. There's some great stories. And for the fact that this is in the Dark Ages and there's not a lot of written history, I can't recommend more the British History Podcast. He does an amazing job and goes like literally probably 100 episodes that covers this period. So there's a lot of stories. We can't get into all the detail, but if this is an interesting piece, there's no better source than going to the British History Podcast.
Yeah, and it's in our show notes. And for folks who are subscribers at historyofmodernpolitics.com or We're Libertarians Podcast Network patrons, you get our full show notes and you get reading lists, and they're really detailed reading lists from all the things that Matt and I have recommended and read and preparing for this stuff. And we'll put that in there. And I'd also say Bede is a good read too. And there's a companion to Bede that's in the book recommendation that helps a lot too. But Bede really kind of goes into all the stuff in a fun way, even though sometimes it's a little weird. So you start to see power struggles between the church via the Archbishops of Canterbury and Kent and the Mercian kings. Ultimately, it weakens Mercia. And in 802, Egbert, king of Wessex, begins his reign, which challenges Mercia with military victories in 825 and 829, establishing the first West Saxon Bretwalda since... What is that?
Cholin.
Yep. We pick up the legacy of Egbert in episode 7. That's how you have to pronounce it. It's just the Anglo-Saxon way, Matt.
That's right. And so, you know, at this point, Bede is no longer, he's passed away. So the notion of Bretwaldas at this time is now beginning to come from the documents known as the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, which were written by the descendants of Egbert. That again, no spoilers to give away here. We'll pick those up in episode 7. But you know, this time it's also important to note that, like, the Mercian supremacy era with King Offa and King Chonwulf, I mean, they were contemporaries of Charlemagne, who we'll talk about in next episode, and treated with him, traded with him, negotiated. So I mean, they were truly powerful rulers and seen and had visibility on throughout the rest of the continent in Europe as, you know, strong leaders.
Well, we mentioned the Archbishop of Canterbury, and religion starts to play a more important role, but we need to start with the beginning. Now, Christianity existed through the Roman period of Britain. You know, there were bishoprics, loose bishoprics in places like York and London. But once the Romans left and the pagans and the Vikings and everyone took over, now pagan, again, is a Christian term from the Middle Ages to, you know, be mean to all the people who weren't Christian. But they took over, and it really started to diminish the presence of Christianity. And in comes St. Patrick. And you all know him from March 17th, and you've heard some vague stories about snakes, and you know the shamrocks and all that stuff. But St. Patrick is actually one of the most influential people in the British Isles. He is credited with being the first major missionary for Christianity in the British Isles, especially Ireland. And it existed now. But Patrick was like the first to form a movement around it and set up a lot of monasteries and was hugely influential. We don't really know. There's a two Patrick's theory. We don't know when he lived, but how do we kind of know that he existed and when?
Yeah, we have a couple of written works. We have a declaration or a confession from Latin, and then we also have the letter to the soldiers of Coroticus, right? So in this, he uses the name Patricus, you know, obviously Latin influence here. And through this and the way he, you know, quotes the Bible and, you know, the mix of use with the old Latin Bible and the Vulgate, we think he probably lived in the 400s, right? So this is right around the time when, you know, Rome is leaving Britain and the Anglo-Saxons are just first really starting to settle and establish themselves on the island. So Patrick was born, we believe, in Roman Britain and captured by Irish pirates and was held captive for 6 years. And during this captivity, it forced this son of a deacon to focus on his faith, and he, you know, converted to Christianity. He's able to flee his captors. He returns home and sees a vision, which prompts him to return back to Ireland as a missionary.
Yeah, and this was a precarious position because, and we know all of this basically because of his autobiographical works that we dated in just a minute ago. But his position was precarious because if you remember episode one, there's a clan structure, and you're granted protection based on your joining a clan. And as he moved through the country, he would refuse gifts from kings, which I don't know about you, Matt, but if in the 400s, a king is giving me a gift, I'm probably going to take it. But that is a sign that they are protecting you and they're then under their thumb. Now, he refused that. So he was often on trial or in captivity or condemned to death, and he would escape those situations and ultimately says he baptized thousands across Ireland and starting new Christian communities out of the Celtic polytheism that existed at the time. But there's a couple little things that are associated with St. Patrick that we want to teach you about before we move on to St. Augustine. What is the origin of the shamrock, Matt?
Yeah, so the shamrock, you know, the clover, of course, right, that we see on St. Patrick's Day and associated with Ireland. You know, Patrick would use the three leaves of the clover of the shamrock to illustrate the concept of the Holy Trinity of you know, the three parts of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit all being one together through this, you know, mysterious concept of the Trinity.
So next time you go out binge drinking on March 17th, remember Jesus when you see that shamrock. Now, what about the snakes? Because the whole idea that he used a flute or something like Peter Pan to get the snakes out of Ireland and drove them all out. Is that true?
We probably don't know, Chris, but, you know, writings back to the third century, you know, indicate that there probably were not snakes in Ireland, but we, you know, based on glacial forces and stuff, but Patrick has received credit from histories in the 8th and 9th centuries. So the obvious assumption here is that he made the island so holy that the evil one could no longer exist in Ireland.
Right. And so, no, there isn't evidence that he drove out snakes. It was later revisionist historians trying to give him a prop up, a leg up, and say, look at how holy this guy is. Because many people in later centuries would identify with a saint as their protector and would want to pump that person up. So the next big figure comes along about 100 years later, and his name is Saint Augustine. And no, it is not Saint Augustine of Hippo, the one that you've heard about, or even the great city, my favorite town, Saint Augustine, Florida. Tell us a little bit about Saint Augustine.
Yeah, so St. Augustine is the first major Christian figure then to come to England, and he was appointed by Pope Gregory the Great, who was, you know, extremely influential in helping build the Catholic Church, to become a missionary to Britain in 597. And so the British Church was in disarray. The pagans are here now, the Anglo-Saxons practicing, you know, Norse mythology and various things, because if you remember, you know, the Celtic or Romano Britons are pretty much, contained to what is now Wales and Ireland and maybe the very northern parts of the island where the, what is now Scotland, right? And so the, with trying to get help from the bishops from Gaul, the church is, it's growing and they really need an authority there to help try to manage the affairs. Irish missionaries had tried to help settle a presence with the church, but they really didn't make much of an effort to convert the Anglo-Saxons.
Yeah, they were a little scared of them.
They were a little scared.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that, like in the book of Acts, you see Peter and Paul settling church the whole second half of the Bible. The New Testament is Paul trying to help settle issues within the church because it was a very important structure to settle disputes between people. So there's some speculation that the wife of King Ethelbert of Kent that we mentioned earlier was a Christian. Her name was Bertha, and she wanted her pagan husband to allow her the freedom to worship, and that he then sent for a holy man to come from Rome to the island to talk this religion over. Now, another story about the prompting of St. Augustine being sent to the island comes from our friend Bede, and he recounts that Pope Gregory saw two fair-haired British slave children with angelic features, and he was so taken by their looks and their holiness that he wanted to convert their people to Christianity. Now, Bede, remember, is a historian trying to promote the English people and make them great. Now, it is probably more likely that Gregory wanted to settle out of these disputes and sent someone to Kent because it was the main power base in England at the time, and it was best situated to communicate with the European continent.
Continent, yeah. If you remember, right, Kent is in the southeast corner of England, which is the closest part to the English Channel to mainland Europe, across the Channel to France there. And I've got to back up for just a second on the Pope Gregory story from Bede, because even in Latin, the play on words works, and the joke is that I'll probably not get this exactly right, but Pope Gregory was like, "Oh, they're not Angles, they are angels,
right?"
So right. Not Angles as in the Germanic tribe of the Angles that we've talked about, but angels, and it works in Latin as well.
And that was not a slip up. Pope Gregory was making a joke, and he was often a very witty pope, and would tell jokes like that, and was trying to make his boys laugh. Now, Augustine was well-educated, but a bit terrified of the prospect of this mission, so he was, like, begging Gregory to come back, because he had a really cushy position as head of a Benedictine monastery in Rome, St. Andrew's, I believe it was, and so he was not looking to leave Rome to go to, like, the wilds of Britain to talk to a bunch of rough Anglo-Saxon kings, but he went through, he was denied the reprieve, he went through. And he traveled on to Kent, and Bede recounts this great meeting with Ethelbert, and he converted him to Christianity, which meant his entire kingdom had to convert as well. And the reason this is important is that this is the first in a trend that led to a growth strategy for the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church. By marrying power and religion, Matt, the number of souls saved would be much greater in the numbers than of speaking to people one-on-one. If you got to report back to the Pope how you're doing, if you need to show how many TPS reports you got, isn't it better to have 500 than one?
Absolutely. And the timing couldn't have been more fortuitous here, because Ethelbert, if you recall from the earlier part of the episode here, was one of the Bretwaldas. So, it just so happened that at the time that Ethelbert happened to marry Bertha, who we believe was Christian, I think if I recall, she was actually from Belgium, modern day Belgium, if I recall. Now you've got Ethelbert, who has some sort of kind of Bretwalda supremacy power over other parts of the Heptarchy, now a Christian and able to extend that influence even further.
The church got to operate and avoided the problems of St. Patrick, and so it was just a great idea to marry. Think about now. You want to get ahead, you really got to buy a politician. So the Archbishop of Canterbury, we mentioned that, and you've probably heard of it. The Archbishop of Canterbury seems like a big deal, but you may not know why it's important. It's the symbolic head of the Anglican Church, and it is the holder of one of the five great sees, S-E-E-S, which means like a regulatory boundary. I don't know another way to put it.
A holy district or something like that.
So along with York, London, Durham, and Winchester, and the Archbishop of Canterbury is ex officio, one of the Lords Spiritual of the House of Lords, and he's one of the highest ranking men in England, ranking directly below the royal family. Thank you to Wikipedia for that paragraph. Mm-hmm. Now, Matt, Gregory had sent him thinking that there ought to be two archbishoprics, one in London and the other in York, but he didn't understand what was going on. So it ended up basically in Canterbury because it was a better base. They could get the land. They worked with Ethelbert, and this ends up setting up the eventual feuds between Canterbury in the south and York in the north, as we'll see many times and many episodes over. But I think before we close up, we should talk a little bit about, you know, we know a lot of this because of Bede and the monastic culture, and there's a great book called How the Irish Saved Civilization. Why were monasteries and monastic culture at this point so important?
Well, I mean, the most important piece here, right, is it is principally the only place where education is happening in any sort of structured way, right? So, you know, we'll get into feudalism and you know, kind of life in the Dark Ages and early Middle Ages here later, but, you know, the monastery is established as the place where you can go learn. There's the only place where there are books, and people who can write. So the history that we have received is largely tied to either monasteries or through the offices of the king.
Yeah. And it should also be noted, like, it gives you a measure of power and influence over the times, because, you know, when Bede wrote his work, it was dedicated to a king, and it was circulated amongst the nobility and the kings and the political powers and the heads of churches and the literate people at the time. And it was almost like he was writing the history, like Thomas Paine was writing in 1775 to convince people of something, right? And it should be noted that Bede never, in the history of the ecclesiastical history of the British Isles, right? Meaning the history of the church in Britain, he never mentioned St. Patrick. And because St. Patrick was the head of a Celtic Christianity that the Roman Christians didn't like and often argued over about the date of Easter and practices and how you wear your hair called the tonsure. Like, think of Friar Tuck with the circle, and that's not good. You need to have your whole front of your head shaved instead of just the back circle. And so many of the history that we are reading today was written by these monks, and it had a political backing and they're also limited by what they can find. Like, he was very the monastery he was in had a ton of books, but it was still a limited history because you didn't have archaeology yet, you didn't have carbon dating, you didn't have the vantage point that we have. But Bede is a fascinating read, and I highly recommend it. Any final thoughts here, Matt, on that?
No, I mean, I think that's a great summary, and you know, the place that monasteries and monasticism play will be a theme that will come up through future episodes. And, you know, the differences between the Celtic Church and the Roman Catholic Church, like you mentioned, I mean, still different flavors of Catholicism, different flavors of Christianity, very much mirror some of the schisms and debates that were happening in on the continent between the, you know, Western Church and the Eastern Church, the, you know, the Byzantines and such. So, you know, I think we can leave it there for this week. We're going to pivot for the next episode and follow roughly the exact same time period, but move back over onto the European continent. So that's what we've got to look forward to next.
Thank you for listening to the History of Modern Politics. We really appreciate it. We'd love for you to go and support the show. If you're enjoying this over at History of Modern Politics, join there. You get our show notes, our reading list. You get the episodes, early release of the episodes, commercial-free episodes. You can get that either at historyofmodernpolitics.com or become a member of the We Are Libertarians podcast network, Patreon at joinwallplus.com. Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we appreciate you, the listener. And if you enjoy this, the number one thing you can do is share this, tell people about us. That's the best way a podcast grows. And we will see you again in 2 weeks.